You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 167 by Rudolf Steiner, a book entitled The Human Spirit, Past and Present, Occult Fraternities, and the Mystery of Golgotha. 12 lectures, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 2, given on the 7th of March, 1916. Returning to various matters we have been speaking of recently, and have often spoken of in the past, I would like to expand on some of these things and, to begin with, make certain comments about the inner nature of the human being, our being of spirit and soul. As you know, we can identify an aspect of our inner life that we refer to in abstract terms as the etheric body. Whereas the human physical body can be perceived by the outer senses, by external science, which is dependent on reason and sensory observation, the etheric body is supersensible in nature. Then we also speak of the next level of the human being as the astral body. We should recall here our frequent emphasis on the fact that our inner life is not something entirely unknown to us. In the physical world within our corporeal existence, we also perceive our thinking, feeling, and will. We experience them inwardly, and also experience them illumined and irradiated by the I capital. We can say that this thinking, feeling, and will is something we inwardly perceive, but we cannot say, as you will gradually have become accustomed to thinking, that we actually perceive our astral body, nor that we actually perceive our I. You see, this I of which we speak, as we showed in the course of our recent lectures, which returns to unconsciousness every time we fall asleep, is only a picture of the true, real I. In a sense, then, we can conclude that along with this I, our thinking, feeling, and will are similarly only an expression, a manifestation of our true inner nature, just as the physical body is a manifestation or expression of the spiritual aspect we call the ether body. Naturally, we are pleased when we can nicely compartmentalize any field of knowledge, box it up and store it away in neat categories. Many are happy to possess the really extremely phenomenological knowledge that the human being consists of physical body, ether body, astral body, and I. But in fact, and I have often stressed this here, these four designations are not much more than words, verbal expressions. If we wish to proceed to real observation, then in a sense we must always go beyond the confines that are so easily set by these terms. Of course, one can speak generally and say that thinking, feeling, and will occur within the astral body. But this encompasses the reality of thinking only in a very one-sided, very abstract manner. As we stand, initially, within the physical world, the impulse for our thinking does indeed lie in the astral body, even in the I, but thinking develops as picturing capacity, as thought, only by virtue of our mobile etheric body. Here, as physical human beings, our whole thinking would remain unconscious for us if the astral body did not send its impulses of thinking into the etheric body, whose mobile character absorbs and incorporates them. And every thought, in turn, would simply fade without memory if we did not also have a physical body. We cannot say that the physical body is the bearer of memory, the etheric body is. But for us human beings in the physical body, the thinking that remains available to us in the etheric body would fade and disappear as dreams do, if it could not inscribe itself into the physical matter of the physical body. In other words, it is only by virtue of our physical body that our thoughts can impinge upon this body. So you can see what a complex process this thinking really is. Its impulses originate in the astral body, or even already in the eye. And then these impulses communicate themselves to and continue on into the etheric body, there calling forth thoughts, which in turn engrave or inscribe their traces into the physical body. By inscribing themselves in this way, they can in turn be drawn forth again from memory during physical life. Now, let us once again consider something we have frequently addressed here, the actual nature of memory for us here in the physical body. We have experiences, don't we? And we process them. We move on from them. And a time may come when we know more or less nothing of them, hardly relate to them. But then a time comes again when we draw such experiences forth from ourselves, from our inner life, and then, in the form of memories, we become aware again of what we once experienced. It is perfectly right to think, initially, that this memory process belongs to us, to our soul. When we walk along the road, gather in social groups, no one can see, with outward physical sense organs, what experiences we have had and what memories we bear within us. We bear this within our soul. One can put it like this. The envelope of the physical body is like a cloak within which, in our soul, we store our concealed memories. They belong to us, and throughout our lives we work upon ourselves in this way. In a sense, we make the outer world into our inner world. And then we bear this outer world with us through our lives, in the form of memories. We bear these memories with us as our most intrinsic possession. But it would be a serious mistake to think that this bearing of our memories through life encompasses the whole process. That is not so. Darwin, for instance, was right to study whether creatures, such as earthworms, have a special task. And he found that they do not exist only for the sake of it, but in boring through the ground have a vital part to play in soil fertility. Such things are acknowledged by science as a domain of certain knowledge. There is nothing to object to here, for it is good if science engages with specific phenomena. The problem comes when whole world views are derived from such things. Naturally, we must recall here the proverb about the man who digs eagerly for treasure, but is happy merely to find earthworms. Translated into spiritual terms, we can ask this: is the human activity, by means of which we continually form experiences into thoughts and preserve them in memories, of no significance at all for the rest of the universe? Is this process of memory really only one that occurs within our own confines? The materialist will inevitably say that this process, of course, occurs only within us. At death, we lay our physical body in the grave, and everything we preserved as memory is then, of course, over, like a flame extinguished. I will not try to refute this materialistic assumption here. We have often done so in the past. I want to consider something else instead, asking this: is it not possible that our process of thought and remembering is, after all, very, very different from what unfolds for us in our memory. While we think, while we form thoughts from our experiences and preserve them as memories, not only are we preoccupied with our thoughts, but the whole world of the hierarchies, the third hierarchy, that of the Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai, is also preoccupied with our thoughts. We do not think only for our own sakes and preserve these thoughts within us, but in doing so, at the same time, we create a field of activity for the Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai. We think that our thoughts live only within us. But in fact, these three spiritual hierarchies are preoccupied with these thoughts of ours. The least important aspect of our thoughts is the one we are aware of. Even when we have forgotten our thoughts, they are still within us. And just as we on earth concern ourselves with our machines or with our eating and drinking, so the Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai concern themselves with a fabric, a tissue spun and woven from our thoughts. They work continually upon our thoughts. In other words, the aspect of thought activity we are aware of is only the side of it turned toward us. There is another, hidden aspect. This, in quotes, far side of thinking, which we do not see, appears thus to spiritual vision. Whereas we possess our thoughts within us, from without, the spiritual beings I have spoken of are preoccupied with our thoughts and weave them in a way that can, when we recognize this, show us that our thinking process is certainly not something unnecessary to the cosmos. It is not for us alone, but is embedded in the whole of cosmic evolution. It contributes to new substance, continually being interwoven with world evolution. If we were not born as a separate person, if we had not developed thoughts and preserved memories, at our death, the fabric that can be woven from our thoughts, that we do not weave ourselves, would be lost to cosmic evolution. And when we cross the threshold of death, an elementary process that we have often described, we know that we lay aside our physical body, which is given up to the elements of the earth in one way or another. For a short while, our etheric body remains with us. Initially, it remains inner experience for us in the form of a great life tableau that it unfurls before us. Everything we otherwise remember through time is unrolled around us in a mighty panorama of our life. But then our etheric nature detaches from us, as if drawn out of us. Who accomplishes this? Yes. The beings of the three aforenamed spiritual hierarchies, and they slowly weave it into the cosmic ether. And thus, after our death, this weft of the cosmic ether consists of what we have embroidered in it, if you like, during our life between birth and death, and what the beings of the three next higher hierarchies have elaborated from this. Thus there is taken from us what we have additionally woven since our birth that was not present before it, and this is inwoven into the whole cosmos. Every person gains knowledge of this after crossing the threshold of death. After we pass through the gate of death, something occurs that we can only describe as follows. The human etheric body is detached from us. Our etheric fabric is inwoven into the general cosmic ether. And so, what we bore within us during our lifetime is now outside us. This is important. Knowing this, we can describe it in a short phrase that we ought repeatedly to conjure in us meditatively, for it encapsulates an important essential reality. Inner becomes outer. That is, what we have always felt to be within us, as our life of thought, becomes external to us, becomes outer surroundings. Just as rivers, mountains, trees, clouds, and stars surround us here, so after our death, what lived within us during our physical life becomes a part of the external world, and we can therefore look upon it, observe it. But now, apart from this etheric body, we also have the world of our astral body. The world of our astral body initially appears in our awareness as the sense or feeling we have of our thinking. But as I just characterized it, our thinking sends its impulses into the ether body, and therefore thinking itself cannot become conscious in the astral body. Only feeling and will can become conscious in the astral body. We feel and will throughout our life. We harbor certain feelings about certain experiences. These are processes in our astral body. This also is a remarkable kind of weaving, but now not a weaving in thinking as I described before, but a weaving of feelings and will impulses, motivations to act. Higher hierarchies here, likewise, work upon our feelings and our will impulses during life. This too is a domain of activity for higher beings. Just as the beings of the third hierarchy work upon our thinking, so the beings of the second hierarchy, including the thrones, work upon our feelings and impulses of will. Imagine how we stand in the world if we know these things, how we feel ourselves embedded in the world of spirit. On the one hand, we tell ourselves that we go through the world and have thoughts, but that this thinking reveals only one aspect to us, an inner activity. Yet at the same time, what we think is substance for the work of the Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai. And, in our feelings and will, we also create substance for the spirits of form, the spirits of movement, the spirits of wisdom, and the thrones, or spirits of will. As human beings, we dig over the earth and work or act upon it. But in doing this, we are unaware that this is only one aspect, and that vital processes are at work which are unavailable to our ordinary awareness. We think our feelings and will impulses are just our own, but they are also a field of activity for the work of the aforementioned beings of the higher hierarchy. Truly, we do not exist only as a physical body, nor as our physical body simply just connected with our surroundings. But we exist also as a being of soul and spirit, which is likewise connected and related to our surroundings. People usually overlook the fact that our physical body really belongs to our whole environment, but this is easy to picture. At any moment, if you picture your corporeal form, you know that you do not only have bones, blood, and muscles, and so on, but also that there is a current of air streaming in and out of you, that you breathe in and out. Breathing in, this belongs to us. But a moment previously it was outside us, and in a moment it will be outside us again. Try to imagine yourself without this in and out flow of air. You can't. It belongs to you. It is senseless to think of the physical body as if it were only enclosed within your skin, since it is dependent on a living interchange with the whole atmosphere outside us. But in the same way that our physical body lives as part of the atmosphere and temperature around us, so in our thoughts we live with the outer environment of the third hierarchy. And in our feelings and our will impulses, we live with the beings of the second hierarchy and the spirits of will. That is how we stand within the cosmos. If we apply this in turn to our passage over the threshold of death, we can say that after our etheric body has been taken from us and begins to be inwoven into the general cosmic ether, we pass through a reverse experience of our physical life during a period that is 3 times quicker than the period of our actual life between birth and death, at the same time perceiving the effects of this life. In other words, we do not perceive what we inwardly experienced during our physical life. We perceived that during our lifetime. If we insulted someone, then we experienced, during our physical life, the feeling which gave rise to the insult. That was the cause, and is inscribed into our karma. But what we did not experience then was the impression which this insult made on the other person's soul. We do not experience anything at all of the effect of our actions and thoughts in the world around us. Here in physical life, we do not experience this. But this is precisely what we experience in our reverse journey in the period between death back to birth. There, we experience everything outside us, pass through it, not as we ourselves experienced it when alive, but as the world around us experienced it. Really, this is so. We experience everything which others experienced and felt as a result of our thoughts and words. And this is because what is outside must now become inside. In the case of our thoughts, we saw how something inward becomes outward. In this life now, lived in reverse, things that were outside us, the effects of our thoughts and actions during our lifetime, become inward experience of the spiritual being we are after death. You see, we now have to live our way into the world in which we live unconsciously during our lifetime, by virtue of having an astral body upon which the spirits of the second hierarchy work. We must live our way into the world where our astral body gradually dissolves in the external environment. But this environment is one we now inwardly experience, really experience inwardly. We have to learn, between death and rebirth, to work in the sphere in which the spirits of the second hierarchy work, preparing what can then lead us to a new incarnation. And after a while, as we know, the astral body dissolves into the outer world, while the human being as such, with his intrinsic core, lives on in the period between death and rebirth. Now, if we wish to understand a little of this life between death and rebirth, we will always need to see things from many different perspectives. That is also our aim in general, not to be one-sided, but to view things from many angles, so that we can gradually develop a comprehensive understanding of these processes. In the same way that at birth we enter into natural processes occurring around us in the mineral, plant, and animal realms, so at death we enter the world that surrounds us in the form of beings of the hierarchies I have spoken of. We are, in a sense, enfolded into their activity. And what we bring with us is woven by them into the underlying substance of our next incarnation. In this realm, it is really very difficult to formulate concepts that modern people can grasp, for reasons I have often identified. Our modern era has the most distorted views of this domain. When someone is born and thus enters upon physical existence, he brings with him certain qualities. Modern outlooks see this in terms of inherited characteristics, meaning by this merely physically inherited traits. If a person displays a particular characteristic, it is said that the origin of this should be sought amongst his forebears. For instance, there is a very detailed book about Goethe that searches amongst his ancestors to discover traits and characteristics he displays, one quality from a great-grandfather, another from a great-grandmother, and so on. Everything has been passed on to him through heredity, according to the author. Yet to say that a child displays characteristics of his parents is no wiser than to observe that you will get wet if you fall into water. A person acquires characteristics of his ancestors because he has guided his soul through them. There is no great wisdom in observing this. To attribute this fact to a narrow cause and to hail it as logical is in fact the most illogical way of proceeding. Attempting to prove that soul spiritual qualities are physically inherited by showing that a genius like Goethe possessed the same qualities as his forefathers is no cleverer than to say we get wet when we fall into water. One might prove that genius and qualities of genius are connected with physical heredity if we could show that the descendants of a genius possess the same qualities. But people are not likely to do this. No one is likely to study Goethe's son to see how the qualities of genius of the father were transmitted to the son by heredity. Of course, there may be cases where something like this is suggested. In Europe at present, there is a statesman whose father was also a statesman. So it could be said that the genius of the father was inherited by his statesman son. However, it is probably true to say that neither of them were geniuses. A much, much deeper reality underlies these things. In our era, you see, people do not wish to acknowledge that external phenomena are merely the outer surface of processes that are, at the same time, inward, that flow from the spirit. Let us use the following hypothetical comparison to show what is meant by this. Let us imagine that there were beings who, while having certain rational powers, were unable to perceive human beings. Assume hypothetically that they could see everything else, but not human beings. They would see clocks, for instance. One of these beings might travel through Berlin and see no human beings anywhere, but would observe that clocks spring up all over the place. This being would have to say to itself, "These clocks arise by themselves." It is no cleverer than this to say that when people are born physically, this occurs by itself through reproduction over generations, and there is no further need of explanation. People only think like this because they cannot see that what happens here in the physical world is only the outer expression for an activity that continually flows down from the world of spirit, just as the activity of clockmakers streams into the emergence of clocks. Moles, for instance, if they developed a science and were intelligent enough to regard clocks as something created by intelligence, might form this view, that clocks arise by themselves. But what happens here on earth, of which human beings foolishly believe that it happens by itself and is only an outward physical process, is in fact governed from the spiritual world in the same way that clockmakers govern their clockmaking activity. And indeed, from the moment I referred to in the fourth mystery play as the midnight hour of existence, from the moment that is poised halfway between death and rebirth, there begins an activity that inclines increasingly from the world of spirit toward the physical world, and which after centuries will guide the human being once more into physical existence. When a person crosses the threshold of death, the activity that unfolds in the world of spirit is initially a processing and assimilation of what this person experienced and elaborated in his last life. This occurs in the first half of after-death existence. But from the midpoint between death and rebirth, preparation for the next incarnation begins. And we can picture it like this. Someone who is born has parents, who had parents likewise, and so on. Picture the expanding scope of these preceding generations, back through 30 generations. But in passing backward through these 30 generations, you would find that many of these ancestors already display tendencies that will ultimately bring together a man A and woman B, who give their child new existence. And if the whole had not happened as it did through 30 generations, if marriages had not happened in such a way that ultimately A and B came together, then the twofold nature they embody, which a human soul can seek out as he descends again to physical incarnation, would not have developed and emerged. In this whole interplay and collaboration of many human beings, culminating eventually in the two who bear a child, the world of spirit is working in accordance with a specific individual's nature. And so, when we see that a son has qualities in common with his mother and father, and that these qualities in turn can be traced back to previous generations, to grandparents and great-grandparents and so forth, through 30 generations, this is because the individuality, who will eventually be born after centuries, has inclined for 30 generations toward his ancestors and has helped determine the way in which people find each other. All this plays its part. And inherited similarities are due to a power that seeks eventually to manifest in a particular individual, working down through 30 generations from the world of spirit. This power is at work in father, mother, grandfather, grandmother, great-grandmother, and great-grandfather. This is always at work, and ultimately gives us the qualities and attributes that need to emerge. Physical heredity does not act alone, but in this way is incorporated into the spiritual stream. The very reverse of what external science asserts is therefore true. In order for Goethe to emerge as the offspring of Johann Caspar Goethe and his wife Katharina Elisabeth, the beings of the second hierarchy brought his ancestors together through 30 generations in a way that could eventually allow Goethe to be born. Naturally, this is not only true of the genius Goethe, but of every single person. You may say that this is hard to imagine, and may also ask how this relates to human freedom. If 30 generations before we were born, how we are to be is already being determined. But the same was true for our father and grandfather too. And if it seems too complex to think this through, remember that this thinking, adapted to our normal earthly consciousness, may not encompass the nature of this whole process, which unfolds in common endeavor with the spirits of form, with the spirits of movement, and so on, and does so in a way that does not in the least impair human freedom. Naturally, a higher wisdom is involved here, and corresponds to the nature of these hierarchies. And thus, what we can pass to the cosmic ether as thoughts is combined with expressions of feeling and will during our physical existence. Truly, spiritual science should not be only a sum of knowledge, but should kindle in us a certain sensibility and mood of soul. I tried to indicate this mood of soul in the first scenes of the second mystery play, in the meeting between Capasius and Benedictus, to show how gods work together with gods, spirits with spirits, in order for a human being to live here upon earth in his entirety, to show how the human being is the goal and purpose of these gods and spirits. This feeling of gratitude, as I would say, toward the spiritual universe, of knowing oneself to be embedded in the spiritual universe, is something that should also stream into our soul from spiritual science. This feeling must become as natural as it is natural for us to know our connection with the physical world. Normally, we overlook this. But science has reached the point today where everyone is aware that he needs air, and thus is not a self-enclosed entity, but a part of his whole surroundings. When a person feels hunger or thirst, of course he does recognize that his surroundings are necessary for his physical existence, and that basically he is a part of a universal process, engaged with the outer world. But in the same way, a person is also part of a spiritual process in the world of spirit. By virtue of his capacity to think, he is connected with the angeloi, archangeloi and archai. And, by virtue of his ability to feel and will, with the next higher spiritual hierarchy. Just as air and substance enter his physical body, so the activities of these hierarchies work into his soul. We have often discussed the theoretical objections raised by modern proponents of materialism. These theoretical objections can be refuted by epistemological reflections and such like. But then the materialists often cite a pragmatic view, which states that while a world of spirit may exist, it is of no help to us to know this, even if thinking, feeling, and will are connected with these higher hierarchies. They say that we do not need to know about these hierarchies in order to think, that we can already think without resorting to this. Likewise, thank God, we breathe. For if we had to wait for precise theoretical knowledge of the breathing process before breathing, we would still not be able to breathe yet. Our physical, physiological knowledge of respiration would not yet be adequate to instruct us in how to do this. People say there is no need to indulge in eccentricities, in quotes, since it is already possible to think without involving these hierarchies in the matter. But we can reply to this with another question. Can we really think without their involvement? At present, you see, people are still depending on a past inheritance from olden times, working still, really, with what they have inherited. And drawing on this, they have been able to invent many things, even machines complex enough to be used to kill others in warfare. But all this comes down to them from a former age. Naturally, people are unwilling to acknowledge this dependency on the past. Rather curiously, many claim that the wonderful progress now apparent is only due to the realization that all thinking of past times was childish, that people have discovered how to think in an objective and sober rather than a childish way. This is, of course, nonsense, and can be proved to be so, even from a quite external viewpoint. Human beings have only possessed their present prosaic form of thinking for a couple of hundred years. Recently, we were in Hamburg and looked at a picture from the 13th or 14th century by Master Bertram. I'd like to tell you the following about this picture. Let us go back for a moment to the biblical account of the fall, which in spiritual science we call the Luciferic temptation. A painter today who paints the fall in our enlightened, in quotes, times. We'll paint Adam and Eve on either side of the tree and then a snake curled around it. Depending on whether he is an impressionist, cubist, expressionist, or some other ist, he will paint this theme in a more or less hideous, sorry, I mean, of course, lovely way, but he will paint a snake naturalistically, as a creature who slides through the grass. This is called realism. But is it actually realism? No. For in what way can it be realistic to think that this snake that crawls through the grass could ever have tempted Eve, however simple-minded she was, and she was not portrayed as being so? No woman, however simple, would be tempted by a naturalistic snake. It is inconceivable. So the whole thing cannot be conceived naturalistically. From our spiritual science, we know that Lucifer is a being whose evolution stopped at the stage of ancient moon. Lucifer, therefore, self-evidently cannot be seen with physical vision. Since during moon evolution, no one yet saw as we do during the earth stage of evolution. This cannot be a snake as we see it with physical vision, but Lucifer must be seen inwardly. If we study the human being in closer detail, as you can do by observing the skeleton, we find the latter already testifies to two parts: the skull with the spinal column attached, within which we have, of course, the brain and the spinal nerves. There is really no other way to describe it than, in quotes, attached. And this, as we will examine in more detail on another occasion, is because the head we bear upon our shoulders is a very complex form, really a small cosmic sphere. We should be truly grateful that we human beings have no hand in our form at birth, and that this head can arise. If we had to draw on our present understanding of anatomy or physiology to create this wondrous structure of the human head, this would produce some fine results. The head arises in a quite different way. Arises because, during the time between death and rebirth, what is inscribed in our karma is inwoven into a mighty sphere that we can compare with the blue dome of the heavens. And a whole formation arises, which, as the soul approaches incarnation again, becomes ever smaller and smaller, and then unites with what comes from the mother. From the whole universe, countless beings of many hierarchies weave what becomes our head, encompassing within it a wisdom of vast grandeur and enormous scope. Formed from all the experiences gained in the passage through Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolution. What is attached to this head is a product of the Earth, of Earth evolution. Our head is an inheritance from old Saturn, old Sun, and old Moon. The Earth, with all its powers, has only been able to give rise to what is attached to the head, which is really the Earth human being. In trying to portray Lucifer, therefore, perceived in inward vision, how will we present a moon being? We will depict it as a human being, with something snake-like hanging down from it, the as yet unossified spine. And this is how Master Bertram in the 13th, 14th century depicts Lucifer on the tree between Adam and Eve. You can see the picture in Hamburg Museum. If people today were able to think, they would say that at the time this was painted, a knowledge of the world of spirit was still alive, one which also encompassed insight into the nature of Lucifer. So it is only a relatively short time ago that humankind lost its old, inherited, atavistic clairvoyance. But not much thinking happens nowadays. However, authority, acknowledgement of authority, is greatly disparaged as something a free human being should not bow to. Nowadays, one reflects on everything and has one's own personal views. And yet having one's own view usually means no more than having forgotten which pamphlet, newspaper, or journal one read the relevant opinion in. People forget where they read things that they repeat as their own opinions. If people really thought for themselves, they would compare and contrast, would see from the way a painter of the 13th or 14th century painted Lucifer correctly what people still knew only a few centuries back, and how one might wrestle one's way through to such knowledge again. But now, I would like to look at the theme from another angle, examining the materialistic assertion that we do not need any influx from the world of spirit entering us and informing our thinking and feeling in the same way as the air in breathing and the food that satisfies our hunger. If we wish to claim we do not need this, we might cite certain materialistic teachings that appear irrefutable. I have often quoted the important criminologist and anthropologist Benedict, the first to investigate the brains of criminals, after death, of course. He dissected the brains of criminals to see whether he could discover any connection between brain structure and criminal attributes. Benedict made a very important discovery here, that they all had a shared characteristic, a truncated occipital lobe that did not fully cover the cerebellum. So, imagine that the shared trait of criminals' brains is a truncated occipital lobe, a feature also of apes, which does not cover the cerebellum. But self-evidently, this is a characteristic of the physical body. Inevitably, one must form the view that two kinds of people are born, those who have a properly formed occipital lobe that covers the cerebellum, and those who have a truncated occipital lobe. Those with a properly formed occipital lobe, it seems, do not become criminals, while those who do not inevitably become criminals, it seems they have no other choice. In the face of these findings, to which no objection can be made, since they are absolutely correct from a materialistic perspective, all our talk of morality becomes farcical, doesn't it? Is it right to punish people if they are unable to become anything other than criminals because of a truncated occipital lobe? This is the increasingly aberrant direction in which materialism takes us. Inevitably, it extinguishes everything spiritual in the social, ethical, and legal domain, or else it must continually subscribe to a lie. This fact I have quoted is right. That's how things are. And for anyone who does not acknowledge a spiritual worldview, nothing more than this fact exists. But how do we counter this point of view? Certainly people are born with a properly developed occipital lobe, but some also in whom it is truncated. But besides these physical factors, we also possess an etheric body that can be developed in a very different way and is more mobile than the physical body. The occipital lobe of the etheric body corresponds to the same area of the physical body. People in the future will need to learn to distinguish between children who have a truncated or long occipital lobe and adjust their educational approach accordingly. They will need to know what characteristics come to expression in earliest infancy due to a truncated occipital lobe. The upbringing for such children will aim at strengthening the etheric lobe to counteract this. A strengthened etheric lobe will make it possible to prevent the damage caused by a truncated occipital lobe. As yet, the old legacy of the past has not faded entirely, but an era will dawn when it has. And if spiritual science cannot inform the sensibilities of people in the new age, then inevitably materialism will lay siege to all morality, all ethics, all jurisprudence, utterly extinguishing the spirit. This would be the logical outcome of it. We can only come to the insights we need if we are aware that just as we inhale air from the atmosphere, so we need the collaboration of the spiritual hierarchies in the activity of our thinking and feeling. But along come our contemporaries, of course, and say, yes, we can think perfectly well already, thank you. Our thinking is excellent. And we do not believe that these hierarchies are laboring away in us, as you say. Why shouldn't we think perfectly well without them? A modern scientist, a very good one, who, however, has a weakness for writing all kinds of philosophical musings alongside his scientific research, unconsciously quotes Goethe's words about, quote, glorious advancements, close quote, in the conclusion to one of his lectures, without recalling the whole context of these words in Faust, and who speaks them. You see, people believe they can think perfectly well, and have no need of the spiritual world to make their thinking fruitful. I could go on for a long time about this theme, but allow me perhaps to offer just a small instance. In my public lecture recently, I referred to a forgotten thinker, Carl Christian Planck. I certainly do not wish to dogmatically defend everything that Carl Christian Planck wrote. However, I did draw attention to the fact that he worked out of a deeper spiritual awareness and produced what was, in a sense, a worldview that accords with the spirit. He died in 1880. No one really gave much attention to his books. A posthumous work by him appeared in 1912, a wonderful book entitled Testament of a German. It was written the year he died, 1880, and a first edition was published by Köstlin in 1881, then reissued in 1912. But it received little notice. I referred to Carl Christian Planck back in 1900 in the first edition of title Riddles of Philosophy, in the essay titled 19th Century Worldviews and Outlooks. But pointing to a worldview that accords with the spirit makes little headway today, since firstly people wonder what the point of it is and are loath to spend their money on it. And secondly, they dismiss it, since a worldview of this kind, which encompasses the spirit, is informed by the spiritual powers that render thinking fruitful. People who think materialistically believe that all such idealists and writers with a spiritual orientation are impractical and know nothing about reality. They think that to engage with such idealists would throw a spanner in the works of practical life, that one needs pragmatists to get anywhere. People who think like this have supped at the table of practical wisdom and do not dip their spoons in what they see as dreamy fantasies. Well, Planck was really an idealist, really someone who lived in a world of spirit and wished to draw on this realm of spirit in a way that actively engages with the world. I could cite many examples, but as I said, I will give just one small illustration of what I mean in the shape of the work of this man, Carl Christian Planck. I did not mention this in my lecture here in Berlin, since one cannot always mention everything, but I have mentioned it in public elsewhere. All the time you hear amateur diplomats, amateur politicians, or even real diplomats and politicians saying it would be disastrous for political life if people listened to these idealists and their views of the world. But now let me read you a passage from Planck's Testament of a German, written back in 1880, where he speaks of the current war. That's right, this current conflict. And here he says the following, quote, "Given a merely national order, no political cleverness or love of peace on the part of Germany will be able to prevent this conflict occurring. The nature of the circumstances is more powerful than all cleverness, and already, despite the alliance between Germany and Austria, the mood of enmity from the Russian East is all the more apparent. And this is because it was impossible to give this region a free hand in everything. Inevitably, constraints had to be placed upon it. When conflict breaks out, however much we must wage it for the sake of Europe, Europe will not stand with us. Just as we will have to fight in the East, so we will also, simultaneously, have to defend ourselves in the West and South. National jealousy will come to expression from all directions as enmity toward the new realm at the center of Europe. Close quote. Let me ask you this. Did any of the practical people in 1880 assess the situation that would arise in 1914, 1915, 1916 in such telling terms? How many of these pragmatists, and for how long, wished to know nothing whatever of the fact that conflict might also arise in the South, for instance? This impractical idealist, one of those so disparaged for their lack of pragmatism, wrote words in 1880 that exactly describe what is happening today. We need the will to hearken to such realities. If we did, we would soon see that we are embedded in the world of spirit, would know that the world of spirit exists, just as air exists for the physical body, and that this is something that renders thinking fit to properly judge reality. This small example may perhaps show you that even if people give no credence to the spiritual researcher, he is right to say this. Using their old legacy of thinking, people can still invent machines, but before 50 years have passed, they will no longer be able to do so if they refuse to acknowledge the spiritual influences on their thinking. Everything that does not originate in the world of spirit but seeks to establish something in the physical world will fade and die. People can still invent machines today because of the old legacy that still exists. What is already happening to a great extent in other fields prefigures the degree to which spiritual capacities are declining. The ability to draw on the world of spirit to incorporate something new into the physical world. In many fields today, this inability is already wrongly called a, quote, greater ability, close quote. No longer to be able to paint a proper face, but just to make haphazard lines on the canvas and smear it with all sorts of stuff, would not so long ago have been called daubing. A real painter will still call it that. But nowadays there are schools of painting that call this, in quotes, higher art, while real art is passé and thought outmoded. The same is true in all fields of human endeavor, every field. The times demand that our endeavors are made fruitful by the world of spirit. And this can only happen if we grasp and comprehend spiritual realities as presented by spiritual science. Great universal tasks, likewise, can only be solved if our thinking is rendered fruitful in this way. Today we can observe infinitely sad phenomena, repeatedly seeing how basically all connection with the world of spirit is bankrupt. We are living at a time which, as has often been stressed, is moving toward a second coming of Christ on earth, as it may be called. The etheric Christ being as second appearance of Christ on earth. But some preparation is needed for it, so that this occurrence does not simply pass us by, or is even disparaged and ridiculed. And even the current events we are witnessing can only be undergone in the right way if there is some awareness that the terrible events happening around us are like a God-given sign that the human soul must be deepened. It would be the most terrible thing if materialistic human thinking survived these dire events, which are turning all society upside down. Yet it often seems that this will be the case. This would be the worst and most terrible thing. And those who belong to spiritual science must inscribe this in their souls as a fundamental truth, so that they really are strong enough to counter everything that comes flying at us from the modern world as opposition to the science of the spirit and a spiritual view of existence. it is so difficult to impress such things on people in broader circles today. In some fields, people seem wholly possessed by distorted thinking. Recently, I gave a public lecture and spoke of how a faded and now inaudible tone still lives on in cultural life, a tone that is no longer heard but still exists in the cultural life of Central Europe. Two people came up to me afterward and expressed their astonishment that anyone still speaks about circumstances in this way in our day. They had not expected that what they called theosophy would cause someone to speak as I had. They were pacifists, and they regarded theosophy as something rather different. It is, of course, a fine thing to be a pacifist, isn't it? Although one must be clear that since pacifism has arisen, we have witnessed the greatest and bloodiest wars the world has ever seen, a fact I emphasized a decade ago in my Architektenhaus lectures. But I wanted to point out something that is easily comprehensible. I said this to them: does it not seem to you that all these circumstances, not just the warfare itself, but the coming to light of such terrible deceitfulness as we can witness in the conflicting voices of nations, is an extreme absurd form of everything that so-called culture has developed hitherto? That it is just the same things taken to absurdity? Yes, said one of the gentlemen, this is certainly a sickness that must be healed. Naturally, we can agree with him. Well and good, it is a sickness. To speak trivially, the man was pleased, as Punch, that he had formulated the right thought, that all this was a sickness. But he had no inkling that this right thought led nowhere, and that it is not a matter of hammering home one's correct thought, but to see the whole context in which it belongs. For example, it did not occur to this gentleman that while it might certainly be correct to say we are plagued by sickness in society, we also have to ask what kind of sickness it is and what has caused it. The cause is a prior dysfunction. Illness, after all, is nature's resistance to dysfunction in order to make us healthy again, and unnatural circumstances always precede an illness. Sickness is an attempt to bring unhealthy conditions to light. You can say that it is a way of resisting the unnatural state that precedes an illness. That illness is this process of resistance. So when the gentleman states that current conditions are an illness, he shows that the illness was necessary because of unnatural circumstances, which we can sum up as being, in the most encompassing sense, the prevalent and ubiquitous materialism of our era. Naturally, I mean materialism in its broadest sense, everything that leads to an impotent power of thinking, to the crushing and oppression of competent people who wish to act practically, but who are trampled under the weight of all those who say they know what is really practical. Of course they know this, but in what sense? Spiritual scientific truths must enter us and act fruitfully in us, in our feeling and sensibility. In our time there must be a number of people whose inner conviction enables them to keep faith with what emerges from spiritual science to further cosmic evolution. Then what needs to come about will come about. Then Christ, in seeking to manifest in a new form, will find those he needs. And this is necessary. When he appears in his etheric form to one or another person, the times must not be such that this appearance of Christ is seen as lunacy. It must be seen as a destined call to humanity to advance, to find a forward impetus that consists, above all, in thoroughly overcoming materialism and all its consequences. This present century must not pass without human perceptions acquiring a fundamentally different form. The significant and bloody events that now encompass us on all sides must be seen as a fiery sign of this, humanity's goal. Then the victims of this conflict will not have died or been terribly wounded in vain. Then everything that is now happening around us will contribute to humanity's ascent. This is vital. And therefore we must ever and again hold fast to the truth so often reiterated here. Quote, from the courage of combatants, from the blood of slaughter, from the suffering of the bereaved, from the sacrificial deeds of the people, spirit fruit will grow, will guide souls to awareness of the spirit, to find their purpose in the spirit realm. The end of lecture 2.